Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 61 of Registry Matters. Happy Saturday night to you, Larry. How are you?
Doing well, Andy. Thanks for inviting me back.
I try to have you here more or less every week so far. I mean, I don't think we've done one without you.
Oh, okay. I was thinking maybe you might have missed one.
No, I haven't done a solo yet, and I haven't had King on to replace you yet.
All right.
So tonight we got a live question from Jeff in Kentucky, and then we're also going to have a guest hang out with us, and we'll call him. He's in FYP Studios in the Hanging Chad State, and that'll be Rick, and I'll bring him on here in just a minute. I'll bring him on now because I want to ask you a question. So last night, the however you want to term it, whether Trump caved or this side won, whichever side won, I want to know what you think about the whole agreement with Trump and Pelosi to open the government, and what is your take on it? Mostly like from a political point, like political strategy. I'm not trying to get partisan and say this side won or that side won, but I really want to know what your feelings are on how that all went down.
Sure. As far as I'm concerned, it was a good move on Trump's part. It's showing the entire United States that we do care about the worker. At the same time, it's getting them paid, and it's showing that we're willing to negotiate. Nancy Pelosi, however, has not once shown the willingness to negotiate. She stated, oh, we'll give you a dollar for the wall. I mean, come on. So as far as I'm concerned, whether you want to look at it as Trump won or Pelosi won, it's the American people that are currently winning in this little argument. And I think in the end, it's going to prevail in Trump's court because he's been there the entire time asking and kind of begging the Democrats to come to the table to talk, to hash things out, and to get this wall funded, whether it's a wall, border, security, whatever you want to call it, fence, border. The whole idea is he's been there. He's trying to get anyone to come and talk to him. They're saying, nope, not only that, but most of them originally voted against getting the workers paid. Well, we finally at least came to a consensus and got the workers paid. Now let's get the border wall up and running. It's absolutely necessary.
What do you think, Larry?
I have a slightly different take on it. I don't think that Pelosi and Schumer saying they won't negotiate, that's a spin job that they're putting out there. They're saying that their negotiation for border security doesn't include a wall or a fence, but there's a lot of things you can do to further enhance border security, which has been dramatically enhanced in the recent decades compared to what we were like under the first Bush administration when they were coming across in waves, and we're apprehending a huge amount, and which has stemmed the flow itself. To say there's nobody coming across the border that's undocumented would be silly, but to say is there a whole lot fewer people coming across the border? Absolutely. It's a small fraction of what it once was. And so they won't negotiate. And I'm not familiar with the bill that they voted against to not pay the workers. So I can't really comment on that. I didn't know that there was such a vote. But in terms of what I think happened, which is kind of what I predicted would happen, is that the pressure on Congress is greater than what you can put on the White House. Everybody has access within reason to their congressional offices. Very few people, unless you live in the District of Columbia or the suburbs there, can put the type of pressure on the White House that they can on Congress. So you've got 435 members elected from the states, and you've got 100 senators, and an enormous pressure was mounting on the Congress. So what I think probably happened, and I'm not on the inside to know, but probably we had a resemblance of what happened in the Nixon administration when his time was up. The pressure was getting so great on people who were going to start going into foreclosure and people who were having to quit their government jobs and go look for other jobs that the pressure was on Congress. And we're starting to talk about public safety, air traffic control, TSA. And the pressure mounted, and congressional leadership probably went to the White House and told the White House, we can't hold back the tide much longer. We're going to have to pass legislation to reopen the government, and we'll be forced to override you, which will be significantly damaging to you for the remainder of your 2 years if you allow that to happen. So, Mr. President, you probably need to reopen the government. I think that's probably the conversation that happened. That's why the government was open with no strings attached at the moment, other than that we're going to open it for 3 weeks and ask the Democrats to negotiate. I don't expect the Pelosi-Schumer line is going to change. They're going to say that enhancing border security doesn't mean building a barrier. And maybe they might allow some discussion about barriers in key places on the border. But I don't see a 2,000-mile border being built, a fence or whatever they want to call it, barrier being built. Now, I'm a little more pragmatic. I would go ahead and give him his money for the border wall if it were me, if I could extract it. I'm about making deals. I would make a deal if I could get for the Dreamers, the people who were brought here without any consent of their own, that were brought here. If we could get them free from the threat of deportation, I would give them the money. You could always litigate them later. In terms of, you can find environmental things to argue about, and you can keep this thing in litigation long past when Trump is in the White House. So if it were me, I would cut a deal. But it's not me. It's Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer.
And I agree with that. As far as I'm concerned, I would agree with that 100%, because he's already offered.
It is only $6 billion. I mean, it's a really insignificant amount of money given the totality of the budget of the United States. I think then it comes down to the principle.
Less than a percent.
Yeah, it's totally an insignificant amount of money. It is $6 billion or five and change, whatever you want to call it. But still.
Yeah, we're only talking, I think at this point he wanted the funding for, I think, 600 miles worth of fencing. And we
slats.
Know that with the slats, right. We know that it works. You just take a look at anyone who puts a fence around their house. The chance of somebody wanting to break in decreases significantly. Look at Israel. They've got the border walls and 99% in some areas of that wall in Israel has decreased people trying to get in by 99%. So we know they work. And all the information that I have, Border Patrol is saying they work. We need them here. We need it. So they're begging for it, and yet Pelosi is not willing to negotiate. Schumer is not willing to negotiate. I think in 3 weeks, we see another government shutdown, unfortunately.
But for what? I mean, you say, fine, a wall works. Great. You make a barricade, you make a moat, whatever. But what are we actually trying to keep out?
We're trying to keep out drugs. We're trying to keep out illegal immigration.
But they're coming from the border. That's not where they're coming from. The majority of the drugs are coming in through, like, airports or other ports of entry. They're not walking them across the border.
No, they're digging tunnels.
So a wall is going to keep them from digging a tunnel?
With the fact that they want to put the slats 6 feet down, it's going to make it much more difficult for someone to dig a tunnel.
Are you from? Give me a moment, Larry. Before, if you'll give me a moment, there's a supply and demand problem here. The demand is for the drugs to be here in the United States. If you make it harder for them to get here, then the other side of that equation is going to fulfill that demand somehow. They are going to supply it. So build the wall all you want. You're still going to have Americans want all the drugs that they're already getting. That is. If you could curb that problem, the wall isn't going to fix your drug problem. So I'm really, really confused on that side of the equation.
Right, but it will significantly decrease the amount of drugs that are coming in. In the areas where there are walls, the amount of drugs and crime has significantly decreased, according to every border city that has the walls or barriers of whatever kind. So to say that it doesn't stop the flow of drugs is also going way beyond what it does do. It definitely stems that tide.
Larry? Oh, well, I would just, I don't want to spend a lot more time on this if we can, but I would just say I hope that Rick has not got to the point where if law enforcement says they need something that we automatically, I think that's part of the problem we have today, that we've been willing to bend over and give law enforcement every power, every tool, everything they say they need. So just because the Border Patrol says that they need that, I'm not ready to just say, well, of course, if you say that, that's exactly what you need. I'm a little more dubious when law enforcement tells me they need something.
Well, all right then. Let's move on. And so we did a question last week from Jeff, and he was asking about split decisions, and you gave what I thought was an excellent answer, but Jeff still has some follow-ups to try and drill in and get some specific things answered. So, hey, Jeff, what did you want to follow up with?
Well, it was an excellent answer, and it's just that it was me that didn't ask the right questions. But anyway, last time I asked about the Sixth Circuit split, and I got that a split means the Sixth Circuit disagrees with others that the nature of the registry being non-punitive. My question is, what about the registry specifically has been found punitive by the Sixth Circuit? Like, I used to be required to register emails, and now I am not. Is that part of the split? Why doesn't my area have to register social media accounts when so many others do? And I read that the Sixth Circuit decided back in 2016 that the registry was unconstitutional. What has been done about that? If nothing has been done, how long does the Sixth Circuit have to do something about it? And if they don't do something about it, what could happen? Lastly, I heard that the Sixth Circuit no longer allows retroactive implementation of new laws. Is that true? Now, I know that's a lot of questions, but this will be the last of them. I think this covers everything that I was wanting to know.
Well, wow, I think those are awesome questions, though. No, that's awesome, I think.
So, I should have had a stenographer here to get all those questions down. So let's try to take them one at a time. The tail end of it was, has anything been done? No, absolutely nothing has been done. The courts are not the lawmaking entities. They just told the state of Michigan that they could not enforce those requirements against those particular individuals. That's all that they did. And I'm not real clear on whether those individuals. Last time I had spoken with the legal team, they had not been removed from those registration requirements. It could be that they have today. I don't know the answer to that. But that's all the Sixth Circuit did. Michigan would have a choice at that point. They could decide on their own free will that. Obviously, the exact same thing applies to the 40,000 people we have on the registry whose requirements were enhanced in 2006 and 2011, which is what the issues were. Those were the enhancements that tipped the registry to be punitive. They didn't say whether 2006 was more convincing, compelling, or whether 2011, but the totality of those changes tipped the civil regulatory scheme to be punitive. So those things are where the problem is. If the Michigan legislature wanted to and were inclined to, they could simply go back and remove those things that the court, if you stripped everything down that was added in 2006 and 2011, since all the previous decisions had held that the registry was constitutional, arguably you would have a constitutional registry at that point. Well, the legal team in Michigan disagrees. They feel like that there was enough prior to 2006-11 that it was also punitive, but that would be a litigating for another day. But they have done nothing to fix this. That's why the ACLU of Michigan is filing a class action lawsuit on behalf of everyone who would be within that zone of having the 2006 and 2011 pylons added enforced against them. And I don't know if they filed that, but I know they were getting very close. So that's more litigation to come. Now, the state of Michigan has already paid $1.8 million in legal fees to the ACLU and to the law school there for all the hours that they put into it. Now, that's not a lot of money for a state government, but you would think that conservatives who are running Michigan right now in the legislative front, you would think that they would be cognizant of they're just going to spend a whole bunch more money on a losing proposition. They wouldn't want a more litigation, but apparently that's what they're going to force to have happen before they actually implement the Doe versus Snyder decision. And I can't speak for Michigan, but they show no intention of removing a soul until they're forced to. And the questions were so many. Let's go back and figure out which ones I haven't taken yet.
Jeff. Well, yeah, sure. I was asking. I was wondering if the Sixth Circuit split had anything to do with why all of a sudden, out of the blue, I no longer have to register my email address or social media accounts. That was a one I was talking about too.
Do
I
you
didn't read any law. I'm sorry, I didn't
reside
read.
within the do you reside within the Sixth Circuit?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And I didn't read any law that Kentucky passed saying you no longer had to register emails. It just abruptly stopped happening. And I was
It's
wondering if that
hard to
has anything
say.
to do with the Sixth Circuit split.
Could it just be his local jurisdiction decided to stop asking for it?
Well, it could be that, or it could be. Oftentimes, they empower the Kentucky registration statute, which I don't have it memorized word for word, but oftentimes they empower in our state to be the Department of Public Safety to promulgate regulations. In the case of Georgia, I think they empower the GBI, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation,
Right.
to promulgate regulations. It could be that through the regulatory framework that they've dropped that as a requirement that they're imposing because their legal counsel could have told them that we're on thin ice collecting this. I can't say why, but Doe's versus Snyder may have impacted that. I don't know if it did or didn't. I just don't feel like I can give an answer why they stopped collecting it. Is it in the statute or are they required to be collected in Kentucky? Are you familiar enough with the statute to know if that's on the list of things that they should collect?
Well, yes, it used to be. And I don't know that it ever disappeared because I can't seem to find updated statutes. But it absolutely used to say that you have to register emails and social medias. There was just an outright ban until Packingham, of course. But yeah, they used to require you to register emails, and then they just abruptly stopped asking for them. And I didn't know if it had anything to do with the Sixth Circuit split I've been talking about.
I wouldn't keep referring to it as a split. It's a binding decision. It's a valid decision out of the Sixth Circuit. So it's controlling authority for and it's persuasive authority outside that circuit. The only thing that makes it a split is that it's the first federal circuit who's found that a sex offender registration statute has evolved to the point that it no longer has the protection of the U.S. Supreme Court decision Smith versus Doe. The Sixth Circuit said that was then, this is now. Things have changed, and I've asserted that to lawyers who look at me crazy. The Supreme Court didn't say you can do anything you want to do to sex offenders with impunity. What they said in 2003 is that this scheme in Alaska, no, it's fairly benign and it doesn't impose any disabilities or restraints. It doesn't prohibit people from working or living where they choose. And it's not much more inconvenient than mailing in your driver's license renewal, unless you're to the point where you have to go and have a visual test. But there's states that usually allow you for a period of time before you're required to have a visual test. You can renew online. And they said, we don't see that there's that more debilitating than that. Therefore, it is not punitive. But they didn't say go do anything you want to do, anything you can imagine. But that's what states have done in the interceding decade and a half. They just keep piling on, piling on, piling on, piling on. And we're not there as advocates telling them, hey, guys, you can't keep piling this on here because you're going to make this thing vulnerable to constitutional attack. Now, you don't want us to bring down your precious registry, do you? And you can actually get traction with that argument. You can tell them, look, you're giving me a gift. When you put this on here, this is going to give me fodder to come after you, and that's what we intend to do. But yes, that Michigan, they piled on a bunch of stuff. And the funny thing is, it's not even required by federal law to be
Right.
AWA compliant. You do not have to have residency restrictions. But Michigan chose to do that. You don't have to have any proximity restrictions.
You don't have to ban
Yeah.
people from Halloween activities.
You don't have to ban anybody from anything. But people, when they automatically vomit and say how much they hate the AWA, and I said, well, just out of curiosity, what do you hate about the AWA? It's usually things that are not in the AWA that they hate. They say everybody has
I
to
thought
register for life. Go ahead.
AWA is just the tiered system, is that correct?
Well, no, there's a lot more to it than that. There's a lot more to it than that. The AWA was designed to get all the states communicating with one another. And having some similar requirements in terms of the type of people they register and for the duration of time they register them. But you can tier everybody for life and still be AWA compliant. They suggest that you have this tier system, but you can do like Florida, you can put everybody on for life, and that's okay because that at least meets the minimum standards. And you can put offenses on the list that are not required, like indecent exposure.
And they don't tell you, well, your registry doesn't comply because you're registering indecent exposure. But you don't have to register that. That's not a sex offense. As far as the feds are concerned, that is not a sex offense. But I find that people often have such gross misunderstanding about the AWA. They think it requires a bunch of stuff it doesn't require. And a lot of that stuff that Michigan has found, the court has found problematic, is not required by the AWA.
Which would then be supported by states going back, and I'm pretty sure Pennsylvania fought saying that it was unconstitutional to have residency restrictions, and then they won that. So they could still be, I don't know if they are or not, an AWA compliant state, but they don't have residency restrictions. They do list your business, your work address on the website, though.
Yes, there's absolutely nothing requiring any type of prohibitions or where people can live. For federal standards, absolutely nothing, and so that's not a part of the compliance package component checklist.
You had a couple other questions, Jeff.
Well, there was one specifically, and it was basically applying to the implementation of retroactive laws. And I keep referring to the Sixth Circuit split because that's all I knew. how to refer to it as.
I think the way you should word it is it's the Sixth Circuit's decision, but that splits with what the other circuits have decided in the past.
Yes. Well, I read that they no longer allow retroactive implementation of laws. They can only apply to people who commit offenses on or after the effective date of the act. For example, in the state of Kentucky last year, they passed laws saying that a registrant may not use the internet to communicate or gather information about a minor, and they did not apply that retroactively, which I'm glad they didn't, but I cannot believe, I thought it was kind of bizarre that they did not apply it retroactively. I can at least understand the logic of that law, but they didn't apply it retroactively, which I thought was very bizarre.
Well, the Sixth Circuit was very clear. Of course, that's not anything they invented. It's against the U.S. Constitution to apply criminal. Anything that's criminal cannot be applied retroactively. They've skirted that by saying that this is civil regulatory. And to the extent that a registration scheme is civil regulatory, you can change regulatory schemes at will. You could change civil laws at will. You could. The Constitution wants you to know what the punishment is, and that can't be changed after the fact. But the Sixth Circuit gave significant guidance in terms of that these prohibitions might have been permissible, except they were applied retroactively. So if those legislators are watching in Kentucky, it would behoove them not to stack stuff on retroactively, because that puts them in jeopardy of a legal challenge based on binding precedent. That those versus Snyder decision is binding throughout the Sixth Circuit.
Yeah. That's about all I've got. I feel like I pretty much understand everything. It only took three whole episodes for me to finally grasp it.
but hang on one second though. So Larry, Jeff and I had a little bit of some conversation back and forth a couple of days ago about this. And so Jeff was like, well, at what point does the registry become punitive? And I started using the analogy of saying, well, when is porn porn? And it's like, well, you know it when you see it, but you can't actually make a definition of it. And we started going down, doesn't matter if it's clothed or not, whatever. But so the question
I love that question. That's
right. So when does it? So is it residency restrictions? Is it I can't go out after 5 p.m.? I mean, when does it become punitive?
Well, and I'll tell you, it becomes punitive. This is the smart aleck answer, and then I'll go in more detail. It becomes punitive when the court says it right. does. But the framework that they use, most courts look at what the U.S. Supreme Court did in Smith versus Doe. That decision was decided in 2003, but they looked at a case that guided them that was decided in 1963, called Kennedy versus Mendoza Martinez. And that's how you look at something that's alleged to be a civil regulatory scheme and determine if it is, in fact, you can call it anything you want to, but there are seven factors in that Kennedy-Mendoza-Martinez test. So the Mendoza-Martinez factors, there are seven of those. They look at those, and one of them is, does it impose any disabilities or restraints? And the more disabilities, I think that is one of the most powerful part of that test is what disabilities or restraints are being imposed. But it would behoove everybody to look at those seven factors, because that would be a whole program to itself to try to go through them. And then one of them, the legal professionals can't even agree on. I take one position of what one of those factors means, and the legal professionals come down both sides. It's whether the regulatory scheme requires a finding of scienter, which is a legal term for knowledge. I take the position that a regulatory scheme that doesn't require a finding of scienter makes it clearly more likely to be regulatory. We don't care if you're going down this road speeding at 50 miles an hour and you didn't see the sign or didn't know any better. That's a strict liability offense. We don't care. We don't care at all. You're still speeding. Well, with violating the registry, I believe that the court, when that factor would be applied properly, to say it is, in order to violate the registry, do you need to know that you have an obligation to register and what the requirements are? I believe that's what they meant, because that's a more serious crime if there's a finding of scienter required. The people who argue these cases say, well, it means, was there a finding of scienter at the time you committed the offense that put you subject to registration? Meaning, did your crime require their underlying crime? I don't see what the hell difference the underlying crime would have to do with anything. We're looking at the regulatory scheme at the point that it's before the court, and that's one of the factors. So I'm thinking that clearly the court wants to know if to be in violation of that regulatory requirement, is there a finding of scienter required? Well, in my state, I don't know about yours, you have to be notified that you have an obligation to register. If they can't prove that you've got knowledge that you are covered by the regulatory scheme, then you're not in violation until you're duly notified that you have to register. So clearly, I like my way of interpreting what one of those factors is. But the lawyers disagree. That's a good thing about the law, is that it's not cut and dry. I believe the court means that. The other lawyers believe that it means the underlying offense. I can't see how the hell you could come up with that as being what they would mean, because we don't care, in my book, what got you subject to registration. We care if you know before we punish you with a felony conviction that you have a duty to register. That's the scienter.
How does somebody reconcile in that those seven tests if it inhibits some level of disability? If you have a 1,000-foot living restriction and work restriction, how do you argue that that's not a disability?
Well, you don't. You argue that it is a disability, and nobody can argue. No,
clearly.
It's not. But the court doesn't give you much guidance in terms of how to weight each of the seven factors. They specifically say that there's no particular weighting. So if you have judicial philosophy, has a lot to do with it. And of course, I'll have people go ballistic when I say this, but conservative judges tend to want to find in favor of the power of law enforcement because they're keeping us safe and all that kind of stuff. So they tend to defer to the power of the state, and they tend to contort themselves and pretzels many times over to justify overreach on the state. The liberals can do that on other things as well. But on this particular issue, when it comes to law enforcement powers, if you're before a conservative judge, you have a lot more difficult time than finding any problem with search and seizure, finding any problem with confrontation clause. There's a lot of things, and Justice Scalia was an exception to the confrontation clause. He actually believed in that, and he was steadfast in his support of the confrontation clause. But depending on what court you're in, it's going to be the philosophy of those judges. If you're in an appellate level court where you have a panel, or you're going to be looking at, if you're at a trial level, you're going to be looking at the philosophy of the court. And states that elect judges, they tend to be more where the people are, because that's the people. The people is how they get in office. I know that's not the way it should be, but as you've heard me say before, that's the way it is.
Jeff, thank you very much. I think you did an awesome job with those questions. Those were well thought out questions.
Well, thanks. I tried. Thanks for having me on. And I feel like I got my answers now, so I sure appreciate it.
And you come back anytime, because we love challenging questions, and I'm hoping that helps people. But those are great questions.
And thank you for being a patron.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for what you do.
Appreciate it. And all right, so we got a bunch of articles to cover, Larry. Are you ready to dig in?
I'm ready. We've got what, three dozen?
Yes, we have 11.
Actually, it's 8.
It is 8. And there's some duplicates in there, too, so it doesn't even necessarily... Well, and I guess there aren't duplicates there. They'll be in the show notes. This one showed up twice, and someone in the Registry Matters Discord server for story ideas threw this one at me. And this is out of Arkansas, the good old state of Arkansas, that, hey, there's a bill that's going through, and it will get over to the House. So the Senate has approved a bill that makes it so that sex offenders can't participate in Halloween. It doesn't seem to be some states like Georgia are really restrictive, like you can't have anything to do with it, and then Will in Tennessee can't participate in Halloween activities for like 3 weeks or whatever. But this was voted in 29-1. That level threes and fours can't distribute candy to others or other items to minors as part of a Halloween-related event, and they can't wear costumes and stuff unless they are the guardian of all children present, which I find to be a little odd. But so here we go. More people trying to make Halloween a taboo thing.
It's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. Unfortunately...
I do like your argument. Oh, I'm sorry. We're stepping on each other. I really love that your argument that it's a freedom of expression thing to wear a costume. It's a First Amendment right.
We can have a lot of fun with this one because there's so many angles to work on it. This is not rooted in any type of this is all emotion, makes feel good. It's hard to vote against one of this. I'm surprised. I'd like to find out who the one person was that voted against it in the Senate. but this is something where it's hard to argue against it. And for those who do not understand Arkansas, they have a level system that's based on individualized risk assessments.
Okay.
It gives them an advantage in doing things like this because you've had a due process. It may not be a perfect due process, if there is such a thing as perfect, but you've had a process to determine that you're level three or four. It's not just because of the title of your crime of conviction. So that gives Arkansas a leg up to do things because there's been some narrowing and tailoring because of the level applying this to. So if a person came to me and hypothetically, if I were licensed to practice law in Arkansas and they said, I want to challenge this, hint, hint, if any Arkansas listeners were to want to come to me, I would tell them, well, I don't think we're going to get a lot of traction on challenging this because if we just simply say that you can't restrict people on the registry from because of the First Amendment, I'm going to say, well, the First Amendment's not absolute, and they've done some narrow tailoring, and we'll have to see what the final product comes out of the House and what the reconciled bill looks like if any changes were made. I think this is just the beginning of its journey. I think it's got to go through the House. But when we see the final product, we can take a look at, and although I think there's going to be some difficulty challenging from just saying you can't do this to sex offenders, I would say, well, let's just don't look at that angle. Let's look at some other angles here. Let's look at whether we can. There's the void for vagueness doctrine. I'm already reading in this article where it makes it difficult, a little bit difficult, to figure out what you can do. If you're a parent and you've got kid, can candy be handed out at your home? If you're on the registry, if you're a level three or four, I don't know the answer to that. Can if you're out trick-or-treating, your kid gets hot as the dickens and they want to pull their costume off, are you allowed to hold their costume? Or is that a violation? So we could go down a different path here on looking for ways to come at them with challenges that would not necessarily just say you can't do it. We'd say, well, we you need to clean it up and make it very clear as to what activities a level three and four and an SVP, which is a small number of in Arkansas, we could possibly look at challenges, but it's going to be an uphill battle. And I told them the same thing years ago when they challenged their residency restrictions, when they said, well, you just can't have residency restrictions. And I said, well, actually you can if they're narrowly tailored. And they probably withstand scrutiny because they're not applied to everybody across the board. They're not painting with that broad brush. That happens if you're on the registry, you can't live. Arkansas says if you're level three or four, you can't live within, I believe it's 2,000 feet of particularized things. And that has been upheld by the Eighth Circuit because they have due process. And you can go back and have your risk assessment, your level looked at, and it can be lowered and it can also be increased. We have a good friend.
Yeah, that was the case we covered a month ago where the person was getting leveled by that and he ended up with a higher level. I don't remember the specific, but that seems to ring a bell that we covered something recently where a person had a risk assessment and it was not in his favor.
Well, but I'm saying during the course of your registration requirement, you have to register 15 years before you can petition for removal. But during that 15 years, you can petition to have your level dropped. Well, during that process, sometimes it goes up. You knock at the door and say, I would like to go from a level 3 to a level 2. They say, or from a level 2 to level 1, because level 1s are not put on the internet. And that would be a better example. And they say, well, you're level 2, but now we actually think you're level 3. So then you shot yourself in the foot.
Right,
so,
yeah.
So that can happen in Arkansas. But I'm chomping at the bit. I want to see the final product. I doubt they'll be able to kill it, although I wish them well. But I'm looking to see the final product and see if there's any viable challenges that can be brought against the people in Arkansas on this, because this is nonsense. There has to be a line drawn somewhere to stop this feel-good, I sort of say bullshit. Can't say that. This is a family program.
Let me ask you this question, though, and then Rick, if you have anything. But it says, is the void for vagueness, is it something like where it says the bill also prohibits sex offenders from wearing a costume? And then you just brought up that your kid ends up like super duper hot, whatever. And like you fold the costume over your arm and you maybe like, you know, do like you would with a suit jacket and you kind of like put it over your shoulder or something like that. Would that constitute wearing? Could that constitute wearing?
Well, logically it would not. But right. Void for vagueness is fairly straightforward. It has to give specific instructions to a person of ordinary intelligence of what they need to do to comport their conduct to the requirement of law. If you're sitting around calling the sheriff or the registry officials saying, am I allowed to do this? Then assuming you are of ordinary intelligence, not a genius, but of ordinary intelligence, if you don't know, then that law has failed. And then the flip side of that is it has to constrain law enforcement so that there should be no haphazard enforcement. You shouldn't be in Saline County and the sheriff tell you one thing, and then you'd be in Pulaski County, and those are two counties in Arkansas that are joining each other. You shouldn't be in Pulaski and get a different interpretation of what's allowed to be done. So if we end up with a product on that end of the final end of this that where there's a lot more questions that can be raised about what they're allowed to do, then that's a good for void for vagueness. You're supposed to be able to know how to comport your conduct, and law enforcement is not supposed to be able to invent it on the fly.
Rick, did you have any things that you wanted to ask or hone in on?
Yeah, I mean, I took a look at it, and I certainly had some questions, a lot on the same lines that Larry just pointed out. I don't know anything about Arkansas and their level system. Here in Florida, we have you're an offender or you're a predator. And everyone believes everyone's a predator because they don't know any distinction otherwise.
Right.
But the few questions that I came up with were basically, if an offender goes to a party where everyone knows the offender, knows the status of the offender, and understands the offender's offense, yet still invites them to the Halloween-related event, this bill would prevent that person from wearing a costume or handing out candy at the party? Isn't that a violation of privacy and or at least individual liberty? Who's going to report the individual given that the individual was invited to the party as a known offender?
Now, he came up with that on the fly. You know, that's part of what we're going to be battling here is stuff like that.
Then the second point that I had was the bill doesn't prevent offenders from giving a child candy if they're with the child's parent or guardian. Now, I said with. From what you just said, it sounded as though that meant that it has to be a biological and or stepchild of that parent or guardian. But it just seemed to me that if someone were to come to my house, for instance, and they were with a parent or a guardian, then that person in the house should be allowed to give the person candy because the child's with a parent or guardian. So to me, it just sounded very contradictory. And so the question I have is, does this mean that an offender can allow children to come to their house and can hand out candy as long as the children are accompanied by a parent or guardian.
And also as long as it's not October 31st.
Right. See, here in Florida, I'm not allowed to decorate my house for Halloween. I'm not allowed to have my light on. In some cases, they actually want you to be gone from the residence. You have to go find some place to go. And so I kept thinking about that going, well, okay, maybe then on November 1st, I decorate my entire house in yes. what would be considered Halloween themes and leave that up until October 1st.
Well, yeah, sure. Leave it up for 11 months or something like that.
I've pulled the bill, so it's short enough that we can read it on the air. So let's do it.
Okay.
Be enacted by the General Assembly of the State of Arkansas. Arkansas Title 5, Chapter 14, Subchapter 1 is amended to add an additional section to read as follows. This will be Section 514-135. Registered offender prohibited from participating in certain Halloween-related activities. A. It is unlawful for a person who is required to register under the Sex Offender Registration Act of 1997 and who has been assessed a Level 3 or 4 offender to knowingly 1. Distribute candy or any item to a minor as part of a Halloween-related event or 2. Wear a mask or other costume as part of Halloween-related event if a minor is present at the Halloween-related event. Well, that's good stuff there. So you can't go to any Halloween event costume. B, it is not an offense under this subsection if the person is a parent or guardian of the minor to whom the candy or item is distributed, or if the person is a parent or guardian of all minors present at the Halloween-related event. So I guess they will let you have your own Halloween party.
Yeah, it says you could go to a Halloween event as long as there are no children present. Didn't it?
So, well, you arguably, yes, you could go to it. But
well, that's great. Then all the bars are available.
Right?
Who's to say that alcohol won't make you do another stupid thing?
Absolutely.
So I will put this in our folder, Andy. Or I'll put it somewhere so we can. So
that's the whole bill.
That's the whole bill.
So literally, that news article is pretty much the bill.
Yep, it's Senate Bill 10, so it has to go past the House, and it's going to be very difficult for. And I'm not telling you guys in Arkansas that are going to legislature. You definitely want to go to the legislature. You definitely want to tell them the absurdity of this. You also want to tell them that the national organization is chomping at the bit to try to find a way to litigate them into submission. If they're determined to do this, that we're already looking at what we can do, because this stuff has to stop somewhere.
Awesome. Well, then let's move on to the good old Detroit News. There's an editorial article, and it says the sex offender registry, a foul of constitution. As if we didn't know that already. They bring up that Miriam Aukerman is the lead attorney, senior staff attorney with the ACLU of Michigan, and goes through all the silliness of the registry as we already know it is, and that they haven't made any changes since they lost that court battle. We were talking about that with Jeff a minute ago. And so they're suing them again. And there are 40,000 registrants, so this is going to be a big class action, which is pretty neat.
Well, that's what I was just saying. See, we would normally expect conservatives who are fiscally responsible to say, "Let's stop this nonsense," but don't see an indication of it coming so far.
This is definitely bipartisan popular.
Well, I understand that, Andy, but I'm one of the conservatives who believe in fiscal responsibility and not spending a dollar of public resources to say, whoa, we've had this litigated and it's gone through all the appeals. The Supreme Court denied the hearing on this, and we're still doing this. We've got to change. Because we're trying to save the taxpayers' money. I'm waiting for the intellectual honesty to flow from that. You know, we've got to stop doing this.
And that frustrates me, the fact that it's not being done. You know, if it's already come down the courts and the courts have said, hey, you know, it's unconstitutional, you got to stop this, then stop it. Because the whole idea of being conservative is looking at the Constitution and conserving the principles of the Constitution.
Well, I'm excited that we agree on that. I'm hoping that our Michigan people are putting pressure on their lawmakers, because there's I learned from a former governor of ours in this state, Gary Johnson, that it often takes a liberal to do conservative things and a conservative to do liberal things because of the vilification that takes place in the world of politics, which means that you very seldom find, it is possible, but you very seldom find liberals attacking if conservatives say that we've gone too far on criminal justice and want to reform and lighten up the screws. You will never hear liberals attack on that, because that's something that they're okay with. Vice versa, right. If you want to do things that cut public benefits, it takes a liberal to do that. Clinton's the only person who could assign welfare reform, because if that had been presented to a Republican president, they would have gotten vilified. Because the progressive side wouldn't have accepted that. I mean, they didn't like it with Clinton, but they went along with it. I personally didn't like it, and I think it's been a tragic mistake. You know, it's led to an explosion of homelessness, and it was a misguided policy to limit assistance to 5 years. But what the bigger point I was making is that the conservatives are dominating the Michigan Assembly. Take some leadership. Trust me, you won't get vilified by liberals running against you. They won't say, "Well, conservative Republicans trying to make it easier for registrants." That seldom happens. Now, yeah, it does happen the other way around.
And to be honest with you, I don't see why they wouldn't do it, because in all honesty, they're only going to garner more votes come the next election cycle if they were to do it, because they're actually doing what they said they were going to do. And that's probably one of the reasons why Trump got elected, is because he said that he wanted to do these things, and he's been doing a vast majority of what he said he wanted to do. And based on the things that the country at that time asked him to do in the first place. So it would only serve the conservative base, as well as the conservatives that are currently in office in Michigan, for them to take care of this.
Now, while we move on to the next topic, I'm going to see if I haven't put my foot in my mouth, because there was an election in 2000, and the Michigan legislature didn't flip, because we flipped several house, we flipped some legislatures around the country in 2018 election cycle. So, but last time I had looked, the conservatives were running the Michigan. So I'm going to do a quick look on that, because somebody's going to write in and say, "But if you knew what you were talking about, you wouldn't have said that."
While you do that, you did not announce the name of the former governor of New Mexico correctly. Can you restate the full name of the governor?
That would be Gary Puff Johnson.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure that we had that clear.
Okay. Yes, I have. According to the Wikipedia, and I think it's up to date, it's they have 148 seats in the
God, that's a lot.
Let's see, there's 30. Yeah, it's the Republicans have still both chambers. So it's gotten closer though in the House. It's 52-58 with Republicans having 58 in the Senate. The Democrats are way down. It's 22-16.
And Michigan's a tough state. You know, we talk about Florida being a tough place to be all the time. Michigan is a very tough state to be in if you're on the registry.
It is.
We should come up with a way to like empirically rate the states, not for any sort of tourism kind of, you know, moving, whatever, but just to rank them, you know, like living restrictions would get a score, and how often you have to register would get a score. All those things, just to come up with a shame list of the worstest of the worstest.
Yeah, we've thought about that. We get that inquiry all the time at NARSL, and the downside of that is, of course, is that politics would take control, and the state that wasn't bad would be shamed into becoming worse, because they would become a magnet. They would say, "Well, there's a national organization that has this rating." And we're rating as the most lenient state, which means that there's U-Hauls headed here constantly. Yeah. And then they would bring in statistics.
Maybe we should just do the top 10. Maybe these are the top 10 worstest. And yes, I know worstest is
a word. I wouldn't mind doing the worst, but I would hate to expose the ones that are not as bad. Yeah,
are the shittiest states. Here's where you don't want to be. If you are elsewhere, you're in better shape.
Well, but see, now in the Georgia General Assembly, when they passed the law that ended up being part of their downfall when they had to peel back from it back in the early 2000s. A proponent of that. He was dumb enough to say on the floor of the state of the House
yes.
that I want them to be. I want Georgia to be one of the toughest states. If they don't like it here, they don't leave. That'd be better for us here in Georgia.
Yeah, but you end up in the condition of they can't go anywhere. Where do they go?
Well, it's not our problem. We just don't want them here.
I know. Not in my backyard is what that ultimately becomes. What about Miami? Oh, Miami-Dade? Yeah. You'll end up with everyone living under a bullshit bridge. And then you don't want to announce where the bridge is because then someone will say, well, we don't want them here. And God, it's just, that is the worst situation I can even complex. Fathom. It is the worst.
Well, what you need to do, here's a hint for you in Florida, pass a law that says that even in public areas or under viaducts and bridges that they can't congregate. So consider even making it restricted that only one registrant can be within each 1,000 square feet of space. And that way you can stop them from congregating under the bridge. Have you thought about that, nut jobs?
Are you kidding?
I'm sure Ron Book is already on top of that idea.
Oh. Yeah, that's a terrible idea. Just in general. I mean, frankly, I'm kind of lucky as to where I live, the county that I live in, is Marion County.
I didn't want you to necessarily name it. I was going to say geographically, roughly, where are you? North, south, east, west?
Center.
Okay.
Like almost right, dead center.
All yeah. Right, so you're roughly near Orlando.
More toward Ocala. I'm about 45 minutes northwest of Orlando.
All right.
So, but in this particular county, there is a city that I can live in and have no restrictions based on my particular offense.
Okay.
So I'm kind of lucky in that particular case. But in my particular case, my charge was brought forward from 2002 when the actual incident occurred. To 2005 because they were trying to get me as close to the more strict guidelines that they could get to. And the reason I know that they were doing that is because I moved from Illinois down to Florida in 2002. My charge on the federal charge is transportation of illicit material. And that happened in 2002. It did not happen in 2005. But they brought the case to me at that point, and so they put it down as 2005. Simply speaking, the computer that I had images on it. Of the images, I believe they showed that less than 1% were actually real images. The rest were all fake. And of that, that computer sat in my closet in the packaging that I had moved it in. For 3 years, I never opened it. So at my hearing, few things transpired. The judge asked the prosecutor, when's the last time he looked at it? We don't know. Did he try to send it to anybody? Doesn't appear like that. Did he try to make money off of it? Doesn't look so. Did he try to, did he make any of it? No, doesn't appear that he's made any of it. Judge looked at the prosecutor and said, would you start bringing me the guys that are making this stuff? And my second sentencing recommendation was 36 months. I ended up with 24 because he deviated. Call it lucky, I guess. Of course, it destroyed everything. But
no doubt.
At that time, I was under supervision for 3 years afterward. Most ridiculous supervision I've ever encountered. I'm pretty sure that the counseling I received has actually done nothing to change who I am or how I operate. It was just the mere fact that the punishment in and of itself was enough. I mean, we asked the judge to give me home confinement, and he, you know, chose not to go that route. Because literally that's all it would have taken. I would not have done anything else, you know?
Sure.
But, you know, the retroactive talking about that, they retroactive because I was supposed to be, I believe, a 30-year registrant, and now I'm a lifetime.
Wow. Well, you know, what you're all bringing up there, though, is one of the first episodes that we did was that your situation is not unique.
In right.
That all of our people are going through some more or less combination of what you've just described, which to me then bolsters that, why don't we have 800,000 people trying to push and push back against these things so that we can get back to having some sort of functional life? But here we are continuing to try and fight this battle and just gain numbers just to even start maintaining ground where we have in Arkansas. They're making more bullshit laws that don't make any sense, but our people just keep their head below the firing line.
Right.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
All right, well then, let's move on to this next article, which is super duper fun. I got to think that one of the, I don't want to say it's the happiest days of your life, but it would be a pretty happy day is when they say, hey, we're going to let you out of prison on XYZ date, and that date comes up and they go, eh, maybe not. This you may have some mental health problems, and we need to find some community housing for you. So this article comes from NewYork.com, and it says New York inmates with mental illness are held in prison past the release dates, the lawsuit claims. And it's not like New York doesn't have housing. They just don't have enough. It says that they have 44,000 units of housing statewide, but I guess you still have people with mental health issues that prevent them from finding a place to stay. So they get to stay locked up longer, which is awesome. I'm not being serious there.
Didn't think you were.
Right, right. why can't we have enough places for people to live, Larry?
Well, I'm confused by this article because and I don't know the intricacies, I've only read the article, but it says that some people have, if you on the third paragraph, the group's filed a lawsuit has either fully completed their sentences or reached their approved parole dates. Well, parole, I always look at differently because that's a conditional reintegration into the community. And if you don't have suitable housing, I can see them holding you. But if that's correct, then you fully completed your sentence. I don't know under what authority they would be able to continue to hold the person.
Right.
And now, if they come to you and say, Andy, you and I know that you're struggling with some issues and you've completed your sentence and all of our publicly funded units are full. So you can either go out on the street and live in a tent or you can stay in prison. And you voluntarily to make that your home. Now, I'm doubtful very many people would choose that as an option if it were presented to them. But I don't know under what authority they would be able to hold a person that has totally maxed out their time, unless they're pursuing a civil commitment of them, and that would be the only basis I would know that you could keep someone incarcerated who's completed their sentences. So I'm really baffled by this in terms of why we don't have enough money. Well, it's very simple. Our needs are very, very great out there in terms of what we're no longer the agricultural country that we were back in the founding days. And life is a lot more complicated. And performing and succeeding in a modern economy is much more difficult. And a lot of people have fallen through the cracks for various reasons. And trying to fund those things in the constant era of tax cut, it's difficult because you have too many competing things for a shrinking budget pie. You know, our spending levels in this state are right where they were 10 years ago.
So somewhere where you got charged and convicted, some like legally binding contract made you become a ward of the state. Could you describe the inverse process of you becoming not a ward of the state?
Well, I'm saying when they've served out their time, if this article is correct, it says they've served out completely their sentence in paragraph 3. I don't know under what legal authority you would be able to continue to contain a person in a prison without some legal authority. To confine a person in the United States of America, there has to be a legal authority. Go down to your local jail and say you'd like to check in and tell me what they tell you.
Are they going to just kick you out?
We'll try to check in and see what they tell you.
I don't plan on doing this, so I would like to go with the hypothetical situation.
I can tell you, they need an authority to hold you.
Okay.
And if you go to your local jail and say, I'd like to spend the night here, I'd like to check in for a few weeks of R&R, they don't have any authority to hold you.
Okay.
So if they've totaled out their sentence, I don't know how they would continue to be held unless the state of New York has filed a petition for civil commitment, saying that they have mental health issues and they're keeping them awaiting the determination on their civil commitment. So that component of the group, I don't understand. I'd have to see the lawsuit. People who've been approved for parole and they don't have acceptable housing, I can understand how the paroling authorities can say, well, until you're in the right type of housing, which will increase your odds of success, we're not going to release you on a conditional release of parole. I can see that component, that cohort of the group, but I don't understand how you would continue to hold someone who's done their sentence.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense at all. But we are talking about the mentally ill. So the question to me becomes, what is it about their illness that they need specific special treatment? How bad is it? If that is the case, then they should be providing housing outside of the prison. If they're not providing that housing, why? And according to the article, it appears that they don't have enough housing units. Okay, well, you're also providing housing units for the homeless that are already out on the streets, not coming from prison. They are allocating, I believe it read 20%. Of their housing units for mentally ill coming out of prisons. Is that maybe not enough? Maybe they should increase the number of housing units, maybe go to 30%.
Well, of course, you'd be cutting other people out of housing. If you merely reallocate and slice the pie in different ways, the bigger question is, do we have greater need than what they're funding? And of course, like I said, that requires taxes, and taxes have become very taboo in America. We can't pay any taxes.
Well, they're also trying to allocate 500 additional units through funding so that they could purchase those 500 additional units plus operate them.
So they're asking for $12.5 million. Where does $12.5 million come from? Hang on, let me write a check.
Yeah, exactly.
The only way that a government has to bring in revenue is to tax the people. And one of our listeners is like, taxes theft. And I'm pretty sure you're of the conservative mindset where taxes are an evil thing.
I don't think we've established that.
No, we haven't established that. So here's my opinion on taxes. There is a need for certain things that need to be funded by the government, and the only way to do that is through taxation. However, if I have to give up 50% or more of my income to provide healthcare for everyone, to provide schools for everyone, to provide jobs for everyone, as Alexandria Occasional Cortex likes to say, I'm sorry. I am not down with that. Okay. What incentive do I have to work if I am having to give up 50% or more of my paycheck, of my work, of my time? I'm working half a year for free. 6 months I get to keep, 6 months I have to send to the government so that I can fund everyone else's needs. Now, is there a need for government spending? There is. What is that need? Well, according to the Constitution, some of those needs, not all of them, are the military. Some of them are police forces. Some of them are, in some situations, healthcare, prison. But is it necessarily the schools? I bet if the schools had to compete to bring students in, that teachers would work harder and probably get pay raises based on their work. because you go to a merit looking system. But as far as this is concerned, so that we don't get off topic too far, as far as this is concerned, should the taxes go higher? I don't know. New York's got some pretty heavy taxes to begin with. And in fact, they're giving huge tax breaks to Amazon to bring them in so that they can create jobs. And yet they're complaining about not having enough funds.
So I find myself agreeing with Rick in part. I find that there is a level of taxation that could be oppressive. We've had levels in the days of the end of Eisenhower's administration. We were at 91% marginal tax rate. At the beginning of the Reagan administration, we were at 70%. I'm not sure we're anywhere near that at this point. But where I would take issue is that when you say you're paying 50%, it's as if that none of that's flowing backwards towards you. And that's just so untrue, because everything that you're paying into flows back to you. Every aspect of taxation and almost every aspect flows back to you. And I always find it mind boggling that people don't see that. They say I'm a net taxpayer. And I said, well, also you're a tax consumer. All the things that we pay for benefit all of us. We all benefit from having national security. So we all pitch in. We all benefit right. from having food safety inspections. We all pitch in. We all benefit. I mean, I've got a list of things that we all benefit from. And the one I have the most fun with is about schools, which you just mentioned. People say, well,
right.
you know, I don't have any kids in school. And I say, well, okay, you don't have any kids in school, but you all benefit. We benefit from having an educated population. They're more productive. They can pay more taxes and we have a better society if we don't have people out picking cotton all day. And so we benefit collectively. But what tickles me is that people who are actually receiving gargantuan benefits, I know a father who has three kids in school. And he says he's self-reliant. So I look at it and I said, well, now let's just take a look at your tax bill now. You pay for Albert Park Kirkwood Public Schools, your taxation on your house is about $300. You got three kids in school. And we spend about $10,000 per student per year. So you're about, let's see, you're $30,000 minus $300. So you've paid, you've got $29,700 worth of largesse. You're not paying to send your kids to school. And, oh, well, I never looked at it like that. You know, I'm paying my fair share. I said, yes, you are. You're paying your fair share based on the value of your property, but you're not paying the cost of your kid going to school. So you're being subsidized. Oh, I never looked at it like that. So when we take a look at our lives, we're all subsidized in some way or fashion or another. We're all subsidized by something. And so that's what I encourage people to do, is to think about all the things that government does, whether it be national, state, or even local, and figure out how much your life would be different if those things weren't being done. And I think you'd be living more like in Somalia or Bangladesh, and you probably wouldn't like it very much.
I can agree to an extent on that. I don't know if we'd find ourselves looking like Bangladesh or not, but... you know, it's a good descriptor.
All right. Well, then let's move on to the article from The Advocate, where a judge advances Louisiana public defense lawsuit, calls funding woes bad excuse for violating rights. I don't know if we haven't had King on here. Maybe we did at the very beginning to talk about just the really sad state of affairs of the public defender system. But I know that he's talked about it on some of the NARSAW calls. And this appears to be a lawsuit that is going to do something to level the playing field. The indigent defense system over there is really, really atrocious, and people have their constitutional protections just stepped on constantly if you don't have some money to bring forth your own defense.
Well, that's why I put the article with the big legal team that was his name is hiring the disgraced movie
Weinstein. Harvey Weinstein.
That's why I put that article in, because the Louisiana public defender system is like most public defender systems. It's woefully underfunded. And we've got a state judge in Louisiana, elects their judges. And we've got a state judge who, despite all the efforts of Louisiana to dismiss this lawsuit, saying it's a legislative problem, the judge says, well, the people's rights, constitutional rights, don't depend on legislative funding.
I mean, ultimately they do, because if you can't get the money, you can't get the money. But the judge, to his credit, I don't know how long he'll be a judge. Maybe he doesn't care. but the judge said this lawsuit's going forward. Judge Todd Hernandez ruled last week to move forward with the lawsuit. And the Sovereign Poverty Law Center, I think they're based in Atlanta. They're a bunch of liberal do-gooders over there in Atlanta. They just stay in their own state and quit trying to go around the country stirring up problems. We'd be a whole lot better off.
But
I know that's the conservative line on stuff like that. We wouldn't have any problems if these agitators from the outside came in here. But the class action lawsuit has been certified and allowed to go forward. And the judge is just so courageous to say, it's kind of like the jail. We can't, if a judge, when I say we, if I were a judge, we can't force you to build a jail because we don't have the right to appropriate money. But what we can do is tell you can't put people in this one. We can say it doesn't meet standards and we can shut it down. And it's up to you to figure out. Well, that's what the judge is apparently leaning towards, is I can't appropriate the money. But what I can do is tell them that this system's not meeting adequate standards. Therefore, people's convictions are in jeopardy if you don't provide them adequate representation.
And that goes to something that you've said on a number of occasions. So a law is assumed constitutional by the legislature as it's signed into law. And only until a judge deems it unconstitutional does it then get reverted back or get challenged in that regard. And this is that where these people are possibly, allegedly having their constitutional rights squashed. And this judge is saying, yes, I can't fix it, but I can tell you that it is happening. So we still need the legislature to go back forth and try to improve the system to some degree to where it would pass a judge's interpretation of what would be constitutional.
Well, the judge hasn't said it's constitutional. He's saying that the lawsuit is the state does everything they can to dismiss actions, and the judge has allowed the case to go forward. The class action has been certified, and the case is going to go to trial, which means at some point there'll be a decision. But he's telegraphed to the state that you don't get to duck this. This is going to go to trial.
All right. So I was reading from the last chapter of the book, but we're still in the prologue, perhaps.
We're at the beginning of this ballgame. But for a state district judge, who has to face the wrath of the voters to say that this is going to go forward, that's just extremely courageous. I mean,
very much so, and very conservative too, if you think about it.
And is he? Do we know? Does it matter if he's a D or R?
Well, I don't know if they have that type of system if they run on parties in Louisiana, do they?
Not that I'm aware of, but I don't know.
This would be a good one for King to but I do know that they elect judges. King have said that, and most of the southern states do. But this judge, whether he's conservative or liberal, he's courageous to not fall into that trap of dismissing the lawsuit because the state says, well, it's not our fault. We would be spending more if the legislature would appropriate more. And the judges say, well, that's not our problem. We determine if the standards are being met on constitutional representation, whether the money's there or not. That's not my issue.
Well, and just looking up his name, the second link in off of Google says that Judge Todd Hernandez is hanging up his robe at the end of March. So he's, you know, I guess you could call him a lame duck.
Well, yeah, that explained why he can let the lawsuit go forward, because he's not even going to be the one presiding.
Right. And he doesn't care about it the next go around, you know, what happens in the next election cycle. Interesting. Yeah.
Well, now if they have the system similar to what we do, this is going to be a complex case because the state is not going to give up and throw in the towel. What they could end up doing is bringing him back as a pro tem judge. They do that here because these complex cases will take a judge out of the rotation of doing their normal docket. So if they were to bring him back as a pro tem judge, he might preside over through the duration. Those are good questions for King, but these complex cases, this is going to really tie up a judge for some period of time.
It also, it feels then like, how does somebody have enough, excuse me, ladies, how does somebody have enough balls to stand up to the system and do what's right versus what is politically, reelectable? How do you get someone to actually do the thing with integrity and do the right thing when you have an election cycle coming up that forces you to kowtow to the voters? It feels that a judge should be outside of that process to me.
Well, I was going to give you some answers along that line. There's a number of things you can do. You can educate the masses where they quit clamoring for it, because the masses right now believe that the judges should be accountable to them and do what they want. So you could educate the masses to have them stop thinking that. That's not likely to be a successful campaign. You could take the judges out of the, like the federal system, the judges are largely insulated from the wrath of the public. They're appointed, they go through by president, they go through a confirmation process, they're there for life. And removing one is all but impossible. You know, it takes a really, really horrendous action on behalf of a federal judge to remove them. So you do go the Article 3 route. I think it's Article 3 of the Constitution where the federal judiciary is. But you go that route at the state level. And you remove that. But other than that, it's difficult to imagine what we can come up with, because as long as the people can go vote a judge out of office, I mean, I guess you could find judges who don't have any monetary needs, who don't have kids going to college, and who don't have mortgage payments to pay, and really don't care about the capitalist things, and they live a very meager lifestyle, and they can live on nothing. But judges are just like everybody else. I'm assuming they have kids, and I'm assuming they have student loans that they went through college, and I'm assuming that they'd like to get a retirement nest egg built up. I'm assuming they're just kind of like every other mortal, which is going to cause them to be intimidated by losing their job. I mean, isn't that kind of a normal thing that people are worried about losing their job and their livelihood?
It would seem so.
So you'd have to fix that component of it as well.
I think that's going to be a pretty tall order to try and get them to be educated. We don't have much success about educating people in anything that's politically involved.
No, that's definitely not taking place. In colleges specifically.
All right, then. So that one's a dead issue. No, but maybe, like you said, go ahead.
What I was going to say is that what I found interesting about the article is I wonder what it would be like to actually have enough funding where the funding is split 50-50 right down the line between the DA and the Public Defender's Office. Could we imagine maybe actually cases being given the correct due process just from that standpoint?
Rick, that's a good question. We make that argument here to our legislature all the time, and it falls on deaf ears. Let's just take that leg of the system, just the prosecutors, and take out all the apparatus, because they all tie together when you're prosecuting cases. The DA's office doesn't have to go out and hire an expert. They call the expert that law enforcement has. So a big police department like APD would have a tremendous amount of forensic support. And then they would have the state police as well. And then they can even call on the FBI. So when you're on the defense side, you don't have those resources. You can't pick up the phone and call the state police because they're not on your side. They're trying to put your guy away. But say hypothetically you could do that. My argument would be it still wouldn't equalize the playing field, because you're not only needing attorneys, you're also needing vast budgets for the era that we're living in, which is nothing like the Founding Fathers' days when we didn't have anything much in the way of forensics. Cases were decided mostly on eyewitness testimony, and
there's a pool of blood. Ah, clean it up.
but we make that argument, but then the DAs have a counter argument. They say, well, yeah, they have a little point there. We do have a tiny bit of backup. We do have law enforcement. We do have forensics available to us for free. But then there's the private defense bar. Not everybody is represented by the public defender. So therefore, you would have to calculate that a third or quarter, how many cases are represented on the private side, that needs to go into the analysis. And so when we make our argument for that, we should be funded at the same level the district attorneys are, they don't find that a very amusing argument. But I like the thought, because I think even that would still be unfair.
Right. Yeah. I agree with you that the DA is definitely backed up by too many other government-sponsored offices, and that the number of experts that come from the public defender's office are technically in the private sector. So how would you, at that point, provide the defense necessary based on a 50-50 split, should we say? It's almost near impossible, because the private sector is going to charge what they're going to charge based on the need.
It's a battle that's going to only get worse because the evolution of forensics has gotten to the point that a case is so complex today. And I know in an ideal world it shouldn't be that way, but we're in the world the way it is today, not the way you'd like it to be. You know, we're not living in right. the 1940s. We're living in the almost at 2020, and the costliness of prosecutions, and one thing I remind people of is of the there's the three-legged stool in the justice system. If you look in the courtroom, there's the defense, prosecution, and the judge. That's really it.
Right.
Well, of those of that three-legged stool, two legs of those stool can reduce the caseload. One leg cannot. The judge has dismissal powers if the state's not meeting their burdens to beat deadlines. They can actually grant defense motions. Now, it may not be good for their political career, but they can make their caseload lighter. Prosecutors have complete discretion on what they bring to court. I'm not aware of a law that of a statutory scheme that says you shall prosecute this. I mean, they passed the law where you may prosecute it, and they specify a penalty that range oftentimes, but they don't say that everyone arrested, everyone investigated must be charged, must be prosecuted. I can't think of a whole lot of statutory schemes. So the prosecutors have vast discretion, so they can reduce their caseload. What would the defense attorney be able to do to reduce their caseload in that three-legged stool?
Right. They're either at work or they're not.
They're at the behest
of the prosecutor.
The cases get shoved to the defense side of the table, and the only way they can make their caseload lighter is to do what? Plead out a case.
Right.
So if you're a publicly funded attorney and you've got a caseload of 100, which is not that uncommon, particularly in underfunded states, if you got a caseload of that level, you couldn't possibly serve those clients. So you're looking for ways to plead the cases out because they keep coming, and the state doesn't run out of people to charge. They don't find, they're not very creative in finding alternatives to prosecution. So on the heels of that, let's
move on to the flip side of that, and let's go over the New York Law Journal article on Harvey Weinstein assembles high-profile non-New York lawyers for a new defense team. I can only imagine the 7 or 8-figure retainers and whatnot that this guy is paying for the lawyers that he has hired. So Harvey Weinstein is a disgraced movie mogul guy who has been accused of by a couple dozen women of, and maybe more, and these are like high profile actresses that have come forward and said that to get to rise up in the ranks of their movie careers, they had to perform all kinds of interesting sexual acts with the guy. And what I thought was really interesting is there's an actress named Rose McGowan, and she got picked up halfway recently for some sort of drug possession charge, and she had retained one of the firms that Weinstein has brought in, and all of a sudden her case, she can't get it dismissed or anything like that, and she thinks that it's a huge conflict of interest. I thought that was a really interesting point in the article.
I guess I did a Larry read.
Yeah, it's like you were going to say you did a Mandy read, didn't you?
Well, I caught myself, didn't I?
Yes, I appreciate that.
My understanding, though, from reading that article was the fact that McGowan's case happened several years ago and the case is done and over with, but maybe she continues to have them on retainer. And I believe she may have been a victim of Harvey Weinstein.
Right. So yes, absolutely. She accused him of something similar. Yeah. You're right.
Right. So I think that's where the conflict of interest is coming in. But if they are no longer working any case in regards to her, I believe they have the right. And I mean, Larry, please correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not a lawyer. I may act like one on this show, but I'm not one. But they can represent the other side because they're no longer representing her in regards to this particular case. So because she's her lawyer, quote unquote, is the district attorney who is prosecuting this case as compared to these lawyers who are defending. So I'm not sure based on that whether or not there is actually a what's the term I'm looking for here conflict of interest. But it certainly seems like there could be. Now, as far as I was concerned, if Rose McGowan felt that there was conflict of interest, well, leave them and go to someone else. They've chosen to take on Harvey Weinstein.
That's fair to say that, but you know, I mean, she probably can afford it. I don't know what her financial situation is, but she probably did pretty well from the ghost TV show. Can't remember, Charmed is what it was called. But you know, she's already sunk X number of dollars into one attorney for them to then say, "Nope, sorry, you have to go somewhere else." I mean, her statement here says, "This is why my case didn't go to trial. My instinct was my lawyers had been bought off." You can't just infinitely run around and hire new attorneys, pay retainer fees, start paying the court costs, not the court costs, but the attorney fees in general, and just keep doing that indefinitely.
Well, the question is, I guess, is there a history of it? Has he gone around and bought all the lawyers of those that are trying to put forward the suit against him? I think this is the only time that I know of it.
Yeah,
that's
sure.
What I was saying. I think it's a one-off isolated thing.
But this is a guy that's worth hundreds of millions of dollars. He has the war chest to potentially do a lot of that.
Look, it's disgusting.
Yeah,
he can afford it, so he can do it.
And that's the point of the article, though, is it's definitely to show the contrast between the other side, where we have people that are indigent that are having their constitutional rights squashed. And the reason why that this article is so relevant is because here's a guy with hundreds of millions of dollars, and he could ostensibly buy his way out of seeing any jail time to some degree.
Yeah, we've already seen that happen in St. Petersburg, Florida here, with the whole incident of the gentleman that has his own little private island. But yeah, I mean, it's disgusting. I certainly hope that the evidence bears out that he did commit these crimes. And if that is the case, then I hope he's convicted and, you know, given every day he deserves behind bars. But I don't see anything.
I know you have a counterpoint there.
Well, I'm not an expert on conflict of interest. I certainly can see the allegation there, but I'm not seeing the direct conflict as easily either. That apparently, if I've got the article right, since I've done a more thorough read, I did a Larry read first time through. The fact that Rose had these attorneys represent her on marijuana possession, right?
Cocaine possession.
Does that mean that I'm struggling with the conflict that would forever bar those attorneys from representing Weinstein? I'm struggling to see that conflict.
The conflict is that she's accused Weinstein of whatever these, you know, I don't know what her specific allegations is, but of doing sexual impropriety things with her. And so then that's the same attorney that's representing Weinstein.
Right. But her criminal case was completely different. That was a separate case. And conflicts can arise. There's a trick that people play in divorce. They'll go consult with an attorney that they think that their spouse might use to take that attorney off the table. And then when the spouse gets there and they beat them to it, the attorney says, I already know too much about this case. I've already consulted with your spouse and I think I have a conflict of interest. But I'm just failing to I'm having a struggle with the possession of cocaine preventing that particular law firm from representing Weinstein. It's a whole separate issue that I'm just having a little struggle drawing the connection together. Maybe somebody who understands the deep layers of conflict of interest, but it's not readily apparent to me at first glance.
The angle that I thought you were going to take, though, is after Rick had made the comments about it's disgusting and he should serve all the time and all that, and that you would bring up the point that he should get a fair trial and serve what he deserves to serve. And if he's not found guilty, then you've brought that up to me before.
That's basically what I just said, too.
That would go without saying that I presume all people are innocent. I presume even police officers that I see shooting people off the side of mountains and in the back of the head when they're in a hotel room crawling, I presume that they're innocent. And I think the evidence is overwhelming sometimes, but still, if they choose to take that matter to trial, I believe it's the prosecution's duty to prove beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury of their peers that they did that. So Weinstein has the same right to go to trial. There should be no presumption of anything here. There should be the presumption that he's innocent. That's the presumption. And the accusers have the burden to carry. It's not that Weinstein has to prove – we've inverted this all upside down when it comes to how the process works. The presumption seems to be that if someone accuses you, you must have done something. I presume no such thing. Like I say, I watch videos of cops doing horrible things, and I say that officer deserves the total protection of law. Now, they'll never say that on our side, but I say it on their side, that we presume nothing until it's proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So Weinstein deserves that.
And Andy, you and I discussed this a little bit earlier today in regards to the Covington kids and how quick the media jumped to that they should not be presumed innocent, shall we say, in regards to being accosted at the Lincoln Memorial during the March for Life. You know, they keep jumping to these conclusions and saying, oh, nope, he's definitely guilty. Believe all women, right? We got to believe all women. Look at Kavanaugh. Got to believe all women, even after everything is debunked. No, we still believe her. What I specifically stated was I hope that should the evidence bear out that he's done these things, that he is convicted and given, you know, every day he deserves behind bars. But the evidence has to bear it out. So I'm not saying he's guilty.
Public opinion has definitely made him the guilty party. I mean, he's already lost his CEO-ship or whatever, you know, chairman and all that. And, you know, I'm sure he's not hurting. I'm sure he's not eating, like, you know, ramen soups and whatnot. But he's never going to be in that position of fame and glory and power again. That's for sure.
Agreed.
So, well, hopefully we've at least made it clear that due process, even someone accused of egregious things, deserves the presumption and due process. And you know, I try to be, can't be, then your duty is to step aside. If someone comes to you and you're in the defense business, which is the business I'm in, you say, I'm sorry, that's just, I can't cope with that. The evidence is too great, and I can't be zealous in your advocacy. So therefore, you need to look for another, you know, for someone else to be your mouthpiece.
There's an article from the Marshall Project. This one is really disturbing and very, very sad. That so in Fields of Blood, My Life as a Prison Laborer. Here's a guy that got convicted of about 40 years in Texas for some pretty heinous stuff. But you know that. Being said, he gets into prison in the early 80s, and what you would picture from the 1800s or early 1900s of people just doing like chain gang kind of nasty labor. This guy is out there with, I don't even know, this thing's called an Aggie, and I don't really, can't even, he said it's called a massive hoe, and they're just out there digging trenches, whatever, to plant crops. And it's for 10, 12, 14 hours a day, and it's Texas, so it can't be anything other than freaking murderously hot. Guards threatening to shoot you if you're not working, his bleeding hands just constantly, blisters on his feet. We have a really amazingly awesome, compassionate prison system.
I think I put it in here for that very reason. It gives me
a chance
to talk about who we are. And the funny thing, sad thing, I guess it's really not all that funny. The sad thing is that not much of that has changed in the Deep South. They still, in Arkansas, still in Louisiana, they still use these whole squads in Texas, and they put these people in these horrendous conditions. And even Joe Arpaio, I think, brought back chain gangs where they actually chained them together when he was sheriff over in Maricopa County. But I think there's something that says about who we are. Yes, we want to hold people accountable for their misdeeds, but this. I'm assuming there's even a little bit of embellishment in here. I'm assuming that anytime somebody writes something, as time passes, we tend to look back on it, and the snow was a little bit deeper, and it was a little bit colder, and things tend to get embellished. But even taking out the embellishment, I know that the conditions that these southern states employ and their prison labor are very very difficult, and people really suffer greatly. And that's not what, in my view, prison's about. Prison's not about how much suffering. Prison's about, in my book, putting a person out of circulation that really is too dangerous to society. Not that we find them irritating, but they're too dangerous to society, and we need to contain them until we can modify their behavior through the best attempts that we can make to modify their behavior so that they're no longer present a danger to society. And then we want to get those people back out into society, because I'm a conservative like Rick. I believe that I would rather people be paying taxes and working than me paying taxes to support them. So I want as many people out in the economy participating as all possible. And that's what I think any conservative should want.
Agreed. I honestly thought that that's kind of what I was heading into when I was on my way to prison. I thank God.
What, chain gang labor?
Nothing. Oh, you got to understand. I mean, I grew up in a Midwest home. You know, I've only heard about the worst of the worst of the worst in regards to prisons. So my whole concept was looking at something that's what I felt like I was headed into. And I thank God that that's not what I ended up in. I was at a what's considered a low within the federal system. They have camps, low, medium, high, and then penitentiary. And the facility that I was at had a women's camp, a low, a medium, and then two penitentiaries.
But isn't that a significant distinction, that the Fed system is significantly more humane than the states, at least if we bring in to just say like the southern-ish kind of states? The federal system, and also you're talking about something somewhat recent. This guy's talking about something from the 80s, not that that's that long ago.
No, I absolutely agree, you know, with what you just said there. I'm just stating that my idea from film and TV shows and whatever else, as I grew up, the idea that I had of what I was going into was basically what this guy wrote about. And I thank God that that wasn't it. you actually might get a little mad at me here, but what I walked into was something completely different. We got to move every hour. We had 10 minutes to move from one area to another. I had two sand volleyball courts, a couple of basketball courts, a few handball courts, a track. I had a weightlifting area.
Right. So let that be a lesson to you kids. Before you commit a crime, make sure you do something that gets you fed time.
Do it federal. It's the way to go. Let me tell you. I had, kid you not, I had pool tables with cue sticks and everything. You have to have a job while you're there. And my job was to help the bands set up for their concerts. So I worked maybe twice a year.
That's a hell of a detail there.
Oh, let me tell you, it was the best detail. You know, I got paid what, 2 cents a month, I think but that's what I thought I was heading into, you know? Now I know here in Marion County, I've seen state and county inmates working. I have no idea what their conditions are, but they're coming from the county jail and they're using riding lawnmowers and grass trimmers and other equipment to take care of the roadway medians and shoulders and stuff like that. Do I think that there was a little bit of embellishment there? Almost certainly. You know, but I kind of don't doubt the article only because it's Texas. And you want to talk about conservative?
Yeah. Yep. That would be pretty much the tip of the iceberg on conservatism there.
Yeah.
Independence, and we do what we want.
Do I think it was definitely way too much and too far? Yeah, I would definitely say that, you know. But
let's try and wrap this up because we have just a couple articles left and we are way long already. This article comes from The Intercept, and the rape of Anna Chambers led to a change in New York law, but she can't benefit from it. And the key point of this article, I think, is that she got arrested, She was in a car with, I think it was two men, and they let the men go, but they detained her. And while in custody, they had their way with her, just, you know, and they say that it was consensual. And she went and did it. She did probably what I think you're going to say, Larry, is like the super smart thing is after the event was over, she went and immediately got a rape kit done, and they found the semen of the officers and so forth. But the key here is that she can't consent to sex while in custody. I think that's the key here.
That is the key. And it's arguably, and I'm not going to be too strong on this, arguably, we have to be careful when we define custody, and we got to be careful about how much we limit consenting adults. But the theory goes that if a person has that kind of power and has your liberty restrained, that any conduct you would engage in is not consensual. But if we're going to take that route, then I would like for us to be intellectually honest about it. When they read you your Miranda rights and they ask you to consent to an interview,
yes.
Well, maybe you shouldn't be allowed to consent.
I was totally going to ask you that question. Where do you draw the line? If you can't say, I don't want to have do the horizontal mambo with these officers because they look sexy in their uniforms, what other things could you then say, I'm not qualified to consent because I'm in custody?
Right.
Long distance, sure.
And we're going to get hate mail saying, "Well, you're comparing rape to discussion." And I'm not comparing the two, but I'm saying we have to be careful in terms of where we limit what people can voluntarily do as adults. I find it a little distasteful to me if I'm going to have a sexual romantic relationship, if I've had to conquer by having power. And I did one time have a lot of power when I was a landlord, but I never used the power that way. To me, that's not a fun thing to do. If that's the only way you can get it, then you probably don't deserve to have it. If that's the only way you can have relations, but we got to be careful about how we restrain people, because where does custody start? When the officer pulls you over and you're not in any type of facility, and the officer if the person makes the invitation, can we work this out? And they tell the officer, I just happen to live three blocks down the road, and if you happen to stop by, I mean, I'm sure we can have a good time. I mean, where do we draw the line? And I'm not to sound crass or insensitive, but these are questions that need to be answered, and it's a sensitive situation about where custody starts and what people can't consent to do while they're in custody.
And for me, I looked at it and said, well, that just goes right up against innocent until proven guilty, because you're already assuming guilt regardless of what the situation is.
Wait, guilty by whose count? Like, the woman was already in custody for an alleged crime, and now you have cops allegedly performing a crime on the backside of that.
Right. Well, that's kind of the question, right? So would it be considered consensual if a female officer had sex with a male inmate, for instance? Or would that be considered rape as well?
I would be willing to argue that it's going to be similar.
They would be considered rape, but the reporting of those incidents is dramatically lower.
And exactly.
I can't explain male versus female, but the reporting, there's a lot of sexual activity that goes on in prisons between staffers and men, and very little of it gets reported. The more of it gets detected through internal detection systems. And actually, I mean, did you ever have a guy complain about having sex while he was in prison?
No.
No, it's just not the way males were wired. They're ready to have it. And so you don't get a lot of reports in that area, but it would be under the law is gender neutral. You just can't do it. It's rape, regardless of if it's male or female under the law.
Well, again, I don't know. I say that because I look at it and I go, well, you're presuming before any facts are given on it being consensual or not. And I can only see that particular law going horribly wrong for males male police officers, male corrections officers, because I, like you just said, you don't see the reporting as much from a female officer to a male person under, I'm sorry, I'm losing my train of thought here, but under the, whether they're in custody or not. So I don't think it's going in the right direction. I think that you have lost the presumption of innocence by blatantly stating that if they're in custody, it's automatically rape.
I'm confused. What if that? Wait. You've got someone that has like firearms and all kinds of possession of hardware to detain you to where they could, you know, they have at least an intimidation factor over you. You certainly would have. So if they say, hey, why don't we have, you know, Deuce the Horizontal Mambo? And then she's like, if I say no, he, you know, to take it to the extreme, he could kill me and say it was in self-defense, and juries go on the side of cops all the time on that kind of situation. So then she just says, well, I'll just take my lumps and lets it go. How's that not rape? That's coercion.
Oh, that is coercive and that is rape. But the evidence needs to bear that out. That's all I'm saying.
Here we are, we're proposing a law because the situation has come up. You're like, the cop should have the integrity to not do the thing, but obviously not. That's why we're proposing a law.
Exactly. And I understand where they're coming from with the law. I just don't think it's stepping on being innocent until proven guilty. Because you're not giving any officer the presumption of innocence. What if the woman had, you know, she's under custody and she's the one that initiates and starts the conversation about, hey, you know, if you can let me go, you know, I'll do this for you. Now who's guilty? The officer, because he's still got custody over her?
Yes, probably. Now you have like a corruption thing going on.
Well, you do have corruption going on. So he's guilty of corruption, but is he guilty of rape at that point?
Well, let's just go to the first paragraph. The Senate Bill 7708 asserts that when a person is under arrest, arrest doesn't mean you're in jail.
Right.
Detention, that doesn't mean you're in jail. You could be detained at the side of the road or otherwise in actual custody by a police officer or other law enforcement official. Well, who all that includes? That person is incapable of consenting to a sexual encounter. That's what we're being asked to buy into, is that once you're in any type of detention, whether it be behind the bars or being confined in your movements, that you cannot consent to a sexual encounter. I think that that's a little problematic in terms of saying you can't consent to any. If a bill like that were here, I would want to try to narrow that some and make sure that you are truly in. I would want you in a custodial situation where there's no choice on your own part, realistically. But when you're pulled over to the side of the road, you've got all sorts of choices until the officer puts the handcuffs on you.
Agreed.
Right. You have choices, and people I've heard flash cleavage. I've never been able to make that work for me, but I've heard a variety of what people do. And this has been directly from law enforcement officers that I've had relationships that say that they get offers and propositions on a regular basis. There's uniforms are inherently attractive, and I think they're probably more attractive to women than they are to men. But I'm not saying it's universally that way. But something about the uniform does, and I can't explain it. I don't know if it's the power, if it's sex appeal, or something. But are we going to stop all propositioning?
How is propositioning something like that any different than offering money or something else of value? If you can find the chink in the armor of the officer, then I don't necessarily find there to be a lot of difference there. We can call it rape.
Is that a rape, or is that another crime that you could possibly have? Is it officer rape or for someone's proposition? Or when I proposition you to take a bribe, I'm the one that gets in trouble. If I offer money, why shouldn't, I mean, hypothetically, devil's advocate, why wouldn't the person making the offer get in trouble?
Sure. But you're in custody. You're going to start making not necessarily the most rational of decisions to try and get yourself out of the situation.
Right. Well, but if you're in custody and you're making those things, you are the one that would then, quote unquote, be consenting to whatever it is that you're offering. So this thing is saying that that person can't do that. They're incapable of doing that.
Right. Because so you're under duress.
It's automatically rape. If you're under duress, I mean, frankly, well, you'll say what, I mean, perfect yes, example. Exactly. I think I was under duress when I was brought into the police station.
Well, that was my question. I was told, why don't we just say that anything that you say to police while you're in custody is why don't we just expand it out and say that you're incapable of doing anything in police custody?
Exactly. I saw that going that direction. I saw that.
Yes. Well, I mean, under the Andy doctrine, that would be it.
Right. And that's why I have an issue with that, because, you know, you can go both directions real easily. But again, in my view, I'm looking at it saying you're automatically assuming that the officer has done wrong. Now, yes, has the officer done something wrong? Yeah, probably. They took a bribe or they took whatever it was. Was it consensual? You have to go down that line. You have to look at the evidence to find out whether or not it was consensual on the part of the person that was in custody at that point. I just don't like the fact that they're just automatically assuming that the person cannot make some sort of consensual overture at that moment. Now, if they're the ones that are doing it, I mean, I don't know. I think it's a slippery slope no matter which direction you look at it.
The final article, and this one is something that I kind of have a hot button for, and we'll cover this one pretty quick, is can law enforcement force you to open up your cell phone using your biometrics? And recently there was a case that came out of California where it was some guys trying to extort somebody over Facebook, and a search warrant is issued. And when they go into the house, the way the search warrant read is that you can get anybody on the premise to open up their phone. And a judge ruled that you can't do that. So if you wanted John to open up his phone, and that's what the warrant said, you could get John to open up the phone. But just because Tom is hanging out with John, you can't get Tom's phone opened up. And as far as I know, this is one of the first cases that has held up that your biometrics, that your fingerprint, your face scan, whatever to unlock your phone, is a Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination. And I thought that this was pretty stellar, and it's kind of tangentially related to our people, but still, on my radar and something I was happy to hear about.
It's a good case to bring up because it illustrates the evolving nature of society and life, and the poor founding fathers could never have thought about these type of issues. So it means that we have to do a little bit of thinking, and the technology has and will continue to evolve faster than the law. But what they applied here was the third party doctrine that the Supreme Court has established in terms of how much third party, and would there be a whole program? And I don't even fully understand the third party doctrine. But there are records that are routinely got from third parties, like, for example, subpoenas issued all the time for phone records that are third parties keeping. And what this case evolved around, and this is at a trial court level, likely be appealed, but they looked at Carpenter versus United States, which set new standards on the third party doctrine, which was just decided in 2018, at the end of the term. And the Supreme Court has given us a little bit of guidance in terms of what third party records can be made available. But they said those people, the district judge, the trial judge there on this case that we're talking about, has said that those are just third parties who happen to be there. They weren't the people who were sought. So therefore, their records are not, what's going on their phone is not immediately available because they're third parties. And but it's lovely more a lot more complicated than that. But as society evolves, we have new questions that did come up in colonial times, and we have to figure out how to resolve those questions within what we think the founders would have intended. And we think that the founders would not have intended. Now, four conservative justices didn't think that way, but in the Carpenter decision, but the four liberals along with Chief Justice Roberts did think that way. that the founders would have wanted, not for you to be able to get other people's records just willy-nilly without some sort of due process. So that they expanded the third party doctrine in 2018.
Very interesting. So just to fill in the gap, though, they can't get you to reveal your password if you have a passcode or a password on your phone, but to get your fingerprint or your facial scan to get your phone unlocked, that's what we're specifically talking about. They have held up that your password type things that you know you can claim Fifth Amendment, but things that you are, they have not held so far until this, that you have Fifth Amendment protections against. I think that about wraps it all up.
This would be a good one to follow. It really would, as this case evolves and where the appeal takes it.
This really interests me greatly.
Because they had the battle with Apple, and Trump said mm-hmm. that Apple should be ashamed because they wouldn't provide the government access to the computer, to the phone. I mean, smartphone.
To the phone. Yeah, that was with the San Bernardino thing where the two terrorist type people shot up the place and they wanted to get data off the phone. The government ended up buying some sort of hack for the phone. It was an iPhone 4, if I'm not mistaken. They spent $10 million for some undivulged hack to get into the phone. That's why that just completely disappeared. That's how the whole thing just evaporated off the news cycle.
Oh,
so they paid sort of like a bug bounty kind of thing.
I was a little shocked that a boycott for Apple was called for, but that's what he said.
Yeah. All right, then. Well, let's wrap this up. Larry, how can people find us on the interwebs?
Well, they can find us through a variety of – they can go to registrymatters.co, and that'll find us.
How about a phone number?
Well, I love phone calls because I'm old fashioned. So please call 747-227-4477, and that phone will not be answered 24 hours a day, but we will hear the message. and if it doesn't go on and on, which some of our callers do, try to keep it where that it would be concise and short, and we'll play it and we'll try to deal with that. If it's related to registry matters or the type of stuff we talk about, that's another way.
How about some email?
And that's the favorite because Andy reviews all of those, and those go to registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
And our favorite way for our people, for our listeners, for our fans to support the podcast?
And that's to set up a draw from Patreon for your entire take-home paycheck each pay period. Just go see what your paycheck is and go to patreon.com/registrymatters. And just joking aside, if it's $1 a month, it shows that we're building support and that what we do is valued. And we're grateful because people give different amounts, and I'm shocked what some people give, but any amount is appreciated. It's acknowledgement that we gather here and we provide something of value to you each week.
Thank you guys so very much. Love the patrons. Love all of the listeners. Thank you very much. And Rick, thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate it. And we have run super duper long, but thank you very much for hanging out.
Thank you for having me. And I look forward to doing this again if you'll have me. Like I said, I'm available every other weekend.
Cool.
I expect we will.
All right then. So with that, I bid you all adieu and have a great night. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Good night.